they know how to give good meeting. They know how to interview well and pretend there's, but at the end of the day, it's all about them. Yeah. Those people on a team are the most dangerous, because by the time you figured out that it's about them and not the team, oftentimes a lot of bad things have already happened.
This is the PMP Industry Insider Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome out to another episode of the PMP Industry Insider Podcast, where we take a look at what is changing in the pest and lawn industries, and we take you to the front lines to those that are driving those changes. As always, I'm Donnie Shelton, owner of Triangle Home Services, which has Triangle Pest as well as Triangle Lawn. And with me is the ever-present, omnipotent, can I say that? Is that even a word? Mr. Dan Gordon. Dan, would you like to say good afternoon? We're recording this afternoon. Yeah. Announce our sponsors, our topic, and our very special guest.
Yeah, good afternoon, Dan Gordon, PCO Bookkeepers and M&A Specialists, accounting CFO services for the pest and lawn, as well as brokerage services when you're ready to exit. And as far as our sponsors, if you're interested in marketing for the service industry, Colmarch by WorkWave, visit them at colmarch.com. And if you're interested in industry-specific insurance for the pest control industry, it's PestSure. Visit them at PestSure.com. And if you'd like to join an industry insider peer group, go back to our episode 136, listen to it with David Billingsley. We have put several peer groups together that he facilitates, and it's a lot of fun, and folks enjoy it. And today, what a treat we have. So today, we are going to talk about organizational health. And we are thrilled to welcome today's guests, Patrick Lancioni. Pat's the founder of The Table Group, and he's a pioneer of the organizational health movement. He's the author of 13 books, including The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, Death by Meeting, The Advantage, and several others. And most recently, The Six Types of Working Genius. His books have sold over 8 million copies, have been translated into more than 30 languages, and he also has a weekly podcast, At the Table with Patrick Lancioni. Prior to founding the firm in 1997, Pat worked at Bain & Company, Oracle Corporation, and Sybase. And oh my gosh, what a treat. Welcome, Pat.
It's great to be here. I love talking to specific industries and people who serve and love on those industries. This is so fun because this is the real world. This is the American business lives here. So this is great. I'm glad to be here.
This is where it happens in all the glory, both good and bad. So
there you go. Well, you know what I love though? Man. The people that are listening do real things for a living.
Yeah,
you know, like you know what they do, and we need it. When I work with companies, like I don't understand cloud software. Like, what is that? What does that really exist?
Right. Cryptocurrency. Like, there's something
exactly. That, value to the world. The real world here. Let's do this. This is
great. Well, hey, Patrick, I'll tell you. You know, I know for me at least, I've been in multiple. Dan talked about a peer group up front, and we obviously have several industry, you know, conferences that we go to. And I will tell you, several of your books have come up during both our peer group meetings. In fact, I remember a really close friend of Dan and mine, he recommended The Five Dysfunctions. And of course, multiple people have recommended that book. A guy, and I'm not going to name drop here, but a really respected guy in our industry years ago recommended The Ideal Team Player. All of which I've read. They are fantastic books. I thought it would be great to kind of just start, you know, maybe just give the high level of Five Dysfunctions if people have not read that. Maybe let's talk about The Ideal Team Player. And I know Dan wants to talk about meetings, and then let's kind of morph into what you're doing now. And so does that sound like a good plan?
That sounds great. Let's just have some fun and talk.
Yes.
Yeah.
So let's talk about The Five Dysfunctions. What can you, like, first of all, why did you write that book? Like, what was kind of your main, like, this is what I want to accomplish in writing this book?
So that was my third book, actually. And the first was called The Five Temptations of a CEO. And all my books come about by accident. I don't sit down and go, I should write a book. What should I write a book about? It's like, I'm working with clients and I see something and I go, whoa, I think there's these things. And so I came up with this leadership model when I was working with a bunch of CEOs, when I first started in this field, and it's called The Five Temptations of a CEO. And then a few years later, we realized that people were adapting it and using it with teams because they the same principles, but with a little bit of adaptation. So that's we decided we need to write a book about how teams live through these things and how teams get destroyed if they don't do the right things. And that book took off. So that was the biggest one that we'd had that third book, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, and it's still on bestseller lists and people still read it. Mm-hmm. And we had no idea that so many different industries, we had military people in barracks in Afghanistan reading it. We had sports teams around the world, churches, schools, big corporations, small companies, entrepreneurial things. So we did not realize just how universal that would be. But I tell you, one of my favorite things that people say to me is, Pat, I don't do a lot of reading, but I read your books because they're interesting, they're quick, and they're practical, and I can put them to work right away. Yeah. That was why we wrote it. We wanted real people to get real benefit in a short period of time.
Yeah.
By the way, the audiobook of that is just outstanding too. So I read the book a couple times and then I listened to the audiobook, and it's just an awesome story. So thank you on that.
That's great.
So, and truly, to be fully transparent here, I think this is probably one of the biggest challenges of especially folks in our industry. You know, they come from, you know, a lot of owners in our industry, they were once technicians, and that's how they got into the industry. So they've never ran a team, right? They've never been in a leadership role. And so when they kind of get put in that seat, it's like, now what? Because there's no real book that says, this is what you do. And so that's one of the things I like about The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. It gets very, very clear.
Well, the good news for all those people listening to this is, don't think that you missed out on something by not working on Wall Street or going to business school, because they don't teach this stuff either, really. Right. And the best leaders are not people that are highly, highly educated necessarily. It's people that actually look at what's going to work. And I was a kid, I grew up in Bakersfield, California, and my mom and dad didn't go to college. And so I got a very sophisticated job at a sophisticated management consulting firm. But I would sit there and go, this doesn't make sense. These people don't like each other. They're not even working well together. And I'd say, why don't we help them with that? And they go, that's not sophisticated enough for us. And I said, that's what I want to do. And I love it when a business owner says, wait a second, I can actually get more done in less time and like the people and care about the people I work with more. I want to read this book and do it. And that's what this is all about.
It's so important. So let's talk about those five dysfunctions. So I just kind of briefly wrote them down: absence of trust, fear of conflict, lack of commitment, avoidance of accountability, and inattention to results. So what's the most important? Why is it in that order? Is that any special order?
Yeah, because it all starts with trust, which sounds super obvious. And for anybody listening, they should know that I hate touchy-feely things, like the poster on the wall. Let's all put our hands together. And I mean,
right. Teamwork.
Right. Teamwork is very practical. Exactly. We're rowing in the same direction. Right. Teamwork is very practical, and it all starts with trust. And the key is, so let's just say you're running a local pest control business, lawn care business, whatever else. You might sit in an office 4 or 5 people. Well, the way to get that team to work best together, which means we like coming to work, we get a lot done, we don't get lost in politics and confusion and all that stuff, we just get stuff done, is to learn to trust one another. And that means we have to be comfortable being vulnerable. And vulnerability-based trust is just when people can say things like, oh man, I screwed up, or I don't know the answer, or hey, you're really good at that, can you teach me how to be like you? Or hey, I'm sorry, I was a jerk yesterday. When people can be that emotionally naked with each other, just real, mm-hmm. It changes everything. When you can come to work and you know everybody sitting around the office with you will admit when they're wrong, they'll ask for help, they'll acknowledge when they made a mistake, nobody is pretending, that changes everything. So that's the foundation of teamwork. And, you know, Eric Spoelstra, the coach of the Miami Heat, they use this on their team. He says, I don't know what offense we're going to run this year, but we're going to do this. Because nice. If on a team, the players can't be vulnerable. It works there. It works in every kind of organization. And when you work in a small office, you know that if you can't trust each other, it is going to impact your field staff, your clients, and your bottom line. So the first thing we teach people to do is to trust one another by being more vulnerable about who they are. And so that's the first one. So the absence of trust is where you start. But again, it's not weird. It's not.
How do you teach that?
That's exactly the question I was going to. So how do you even do that? Like, obviously, I would assume that it starts with the leader, right? If the leader is someone who is just like, he can't be or she can't be trusted, or they hammer people. Like, I love the last point about inattention to results, but we'll get to that later. But just how do you, like, practically, like, what do you, like, hey, we're going to trust each other, like, and hey, we're going to get vulnerable. We're all going to get naked with our emotions or whatever. Like, how do you do that?
Easy.
Well, the good news is it's extremely practical and doable. And actually, and actually something people desire. It's liberating. It's not weird. And that is, we start, it does have to start with the leader. When we do these, we'll get a leadership team together in a room or an office, and we'll say, okay, we're going to go through and build some trust. The first thing we do is we say, just tell us where you grew up, how many kids were in your family, and what was the most interesting or difficult challenge of being a kid for you? Not your inner childhood, just like, what is it? We've done this with every leadership team of any kind of organization, any size, any level of sophistication. And every time they do that, 10 minutes later, 15 minutes later, they're looking at each other like, I didn't know half that stuff about you. And they're like, and you didn't know this stuff about me, that you didn't know my dad died when I was young, or you didn't know that we were very poor, or you didn't know that I've struggled with dyslexia, or whatever else it is. When people start by saying, hey, I want you to know this about me, everybody's like, wow, I admire you more. That's great to know. So that's the baby step. And it takes 15 minutes. We call it the personal histories exercise. And it's literally, now some of your listeners might be going, dude, I know the people I work with really well. I know all about them. I'm just shocked at how many times I've thought that. And when the team did the exercise, they were like, actually, I didn't know a lot of this stuff about people. So that's the first thing we do. That's the closest thing to touchy-feely, but it's not. Right. Then we use a tool. Like, we have this new tool called Working Genius. And it takes 12 minutes to fill out the survey, and you get the results back, and it says, hey, here's what you're great at and you love to do. Here's what you suck at. I mean, here's what drives you crazy.
So, and mine is like a half a page for the first one. And
everybody's got two of the six things are the things you hate. And it's so great when the leader of the team goes, hey, you guys, you probably already know this, but I'm really terrible at these two things. They're like, yeah, we knew, boss. Yeah. And as it turns out, that's okay. That's why I need you. Because and once people can start having real conversations about what they're good at and what they're not good at, everything is changing. So now the boss could make a mistake and people go, hey, boss, yeah, you screwed that one up again because you're terrible at that. And he's like, I know.
Right.
And suddenly people are having honest conversations with each other and appreciating each other more. And they're coming to work not feeling like they have to pretend they're something they're not. And that kind of trust changes everything.
So let's real quick, because I want to stick on this point just for a second. And you talked about it. How is that different than like Colby's, right? I mean, like, we do Colby, and I will tell you, I've just been so shocked. And it certainly in terms of level of trust, like, I think people are like, look, I'm not a fact finder. Everyone knows that. Give me a fact finder. That's what I need. You know, I'm certainly, by the way, I'm talking for myself here, because everyone's like, no, you need more fact finding done. So how does that relate? Like, is that kind of, because I know for us, when we did that, the level of trust went way up, because now everyone kind of understood where they were coming from.
Yeah. We've used Colby, Myers-Briggs, DISC. There's a bunch of tools. The key is, are they real? And does it allow people to admit things about themselves, both strengths and weaknesses, and make it objective so they don't feel like it's a risk? It's like, yeah, I'm just acknowledging that which is true. So it's all about vulnerability. Now, the Working Genius is a little different because it's actually about the work product. Like, what do you actually like to do? There's six like tasks, but they're all good. We've used them all.
Gotcha.
And the key is, are people able to say in front of the teammates, hey, you guys, I want to reveal some things about myself that you probably already know. And once it's out there, then you can start having great conversations. So all of that goes into trust.
Gotcha.
But trust is important. Yeah. Oh, I want to go to the next thing.
Go ahead. Yep.
Because if you don't trust each other, you can't overcome the second dysfunction of a team, which is the fear of conflict. And this is a bigger problem in our country and our society than it's ever been. People that work together have to be able to disagree.
Yes.
Even passionately sometimes. And we don't do that in our society anymore. People just flame each other online, or they scream at each other out of their window in their car. But sitting down and saying to somebody, hey, I don't agree with the way you're going about that. Let's talk about it. Let's argue a little bit. Let's debate. Now, if you trust each other, conflict is really good, because you're like, hey, we trust each other. We're just trying to figure this out. Mm-hmm. If you don't trust each other, conflict is destructive, because now I'm just trying to win an argument. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we start with trust, is because it enables us to do the next thing, which is engage in healthy conflict.
So there are some people who absolutely fear conflict, who don't want anything to do with it. And then there are some people who embrace it, and that's part of their character. So how does that, you know, when you have those two personality types, how do you...
Right. And this can be family background. It can be sometimes even nationality plays. And I'm Italian. You talk to a Japanese executive and they don't like conflict, but they just do it differently. you know, and then they go to Italy and watch some guy screaming and waving his hands at somebody. And you're like, or New York and LA is that way, you know, right. Canada. Right. So it doesn't really matter what your natural disposition is. The key is this: do we air our differences in order to solve problems together? And because what you can't do is you can't punt it and avoid it. So trust makes us more able to engage in conflict. It doesn't have to be screaming and shouting, but it has to be really comfortable disagreeing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I almost wonder if like, that's the difference, right? Is like navigating the ego, right? Like, because you said that, like when someone's just trying to win the argument versus someone's really trying to move the organization forward and just, I know I hear it a lot, and I almost think it's trained in a lot of our kids, not to get in some philosophical discussion here, but like, oh, it gives me anxiety when I have conflict. So since it gives me anxiety, it should be avoided. And I'm like, no.
I don't feel safe. No.
Right.
I don't feel safe.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I'm like, that's absolutely the wrong thing.
No. But it's interesting if you, without getting political, if you look at what's going on in this country, you have lots of conflict, but there's no trust. So that's why it's a mess, right? So
And we can go deeper in that's, do we have common core values anymore that allow for that? But that's a whole different podcast, really different one. I'm right with you on that.
So now let's go on to the next one. So, okay. So first of all, you got to establish trust so that you can have the hard conversations, right? And people are okay having conflict. People are okay because they all trust each other. And they know, look, we're just going to work this out, but we're still going to be buds when it's all over, which goes into the third point. So if you want to talk about the commitment piece.
Right. Because if you don't have conflict, if like the three of us are trying to make a decision, and we don't actually air it out and speak our minds and push each other, at the end of that conversation, when we have to make a decision, we are not going to do the third thing, which is we have to commit. So the inability to commit to things, to really actively commit to the decision, is the third dysfunction of a team. And you can't get commitment without conflict. Because if we don't, I like to say, if people in an office or on a team don't weigh in on a conversation, they're not going to buy into the decision that's made, which doesn't mean they get to vote. It's not about consensus and all that. It's about after a team argues a little bit and debates things and it's a good conversation, then the leader goes, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to enter that new market, or we're going to shut down that office, or we're going to do this. And people go, well, you listened to me. We heard it. We had it out. I will commit to helping us implement that. But if people didn't engage in conflict, if they didn't weigh in on the discussion, it's really hard to buy in because they feel like I didn't even get heard. Mm-hmm. That's why conflict is so important, because at the end, even people that hate conflict, I go, well, if you really want people to buy into whatever decision gets made, you better let them argue. And they're like, okay. I definitely want their buy-in. So I better let them weigh in, and I better mine for conflict and say, if you disagree with this, let me know now.
Yeah.
But it's not a vote. It's not a democracy. The leader is going to ultimately make the decision whether he's going to listen to everything, but it's not a vote.
Well, you know what's interesting about that? That's what's so, there's an irony here, you guys. And that is, when you let people speak up, even when you go, well, I am the owner and I've listened to you, I really have, but I'm going to make this decision, they go, well, at least you heard me.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we think that if we let them speak up, we're opening it up to some messy democratic process, but it's not. If we don't let them speak up, even if we make a decision that's pretty close to what they want, they're not going to feel good about it because you didn't listen to them.
Yeah, there's no commitment. The other thing that I try to do, I don't know if this is, I try to speak last. I try to let, and by the way, I have an integrated, and she is like, Donnie likes to go last because she's learned that about me. She knows that I want to let everyone kind of get out what they're going to say. And then, because oftentimes they have better ideas than I do, honestly. And the other part of it is like, there's things I haven't thought about. So if I go last, and it's like, everyone gets to air it out. And by the time it comes to me, it's like, okay, we're going to make a decision. This is what we're going to do, you know?
Yes. Now, and I think that's a great idea. Sometimes it's hard to do that though, because you're like the owner and you know a lot about it, and depending on what your personality is. But that's why what you have to do is say, but I really want to know if somebody disagrees with me. Now, that's right. Why going last is good, because you don't, sometimes they might be sitting there going, I'm going to try to guess what he wants. They go, no, I don't want you to agree with me. I really want to know what you think. In fact, I will reward you for saying, I don't think that's right. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean I'm going to agree with you at the end, but you might convince me, you might not, but I'm never going to punish you for having a different perspective. So that's where trust enables conflict, which enables commitment. You see how these are connected.
Yeah.
Yeah, take trust out of it. Nobody's going to honestly have conflict.
Right.
Take conflict out. They're not really going to commit. They're going to alligator arm things. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Alligator arming is when, like, after the meeting and somebody says, oh, let's do it. And they go, oh, yeah, please. They're like T-Rex arms. They're not really reaching out. They're just kind of nodding their heads.
I thought it was when the check comes at dinner and Donnie, they give it to Donnie.
But there you go. That's right. Same principle.
So there's no commit. Well, okay. So lack of a commitment is another dysfunction. Let's move on to the next one, which is obviously I think it has to do with commitment, which is the avoidance of accountability.
Yeah. And this is the hardest one for most teams.
So important.
We have an assessment that people have taken for years, and and it shows you whether you're green, yellow, or red in each of these areas, our five dysfunctions assessment. But this is not every time, but overall, this is by far the lowest score. Because it's one thing to make a decision. It's another thing when you see one of your teammates doing something that isn't aligning with that decision to go, oh, hey, dude, you got to do this differently. Or what's going on? How come you're not doing what we said we were going to do? Right. This is key. So the avoidance of accountability is so common in society. You know, people see somebody on the team not doing something, and instead of confronting them about it, they talk about him or her behind their back. Not because they're trying to be mean or political. They just don't want to confront the issue. Mm-hmm. But if you have trust, and if you've had conflict, and if you've committed to something, you're like, well, we did all commit to that. So now I'm going to hold them accountable.
Yeah.
And what are some of the tools that you use to hold people accountable?
It's a great question. First of all, for all the people listening to this that are the leaders of their company, I have good news and bad news. The good news is you should not be the sole source of accountability on your team. The leader should not be the one that's constantly calling people. On a good team where there's trust, conflict, and commitment, people will hold each other accountable. It's like on a great sports team. If you watch a great sports team, some guy on the court, like in basketball, makes a mistake and he'll go up to him and go, my bad. Or somebody will come along and say, hey, dude, you can't do that anymore. You don't go, I'm going to tell the coach on you.
Right.
But if you as a leader are not willing to hold people accountable, and I struggled with this for years, I still do, then people aren't going to do it with each other. They're going to go, well, why would we do it if the owner is going to let people off the hook?
Mm-hmm.
So, and the tool for holding people accountable is just having regular conversations where you, and frankly, it's not even about scheduling it, especially in a small business. It's right when you see somebody doing something that they need to get called on, have the courage to go to them and just call them on it. And remember, here's the key to doing this. Here's what really sold me on it. I used to think that I didn't like to hold people accountable because I cared about them so much that I didn't want them to feel bad. And then one day I realized I was actually being selfish. I love them, I have to tell them for their benefit and the team. And oftentimes I would not do it because I didn't want them to dislike me. So what I say is this: if you love the people who work with you and for you, and you should care about them that much, you owe it to them to tell them when they're doing something that's not measuring up, because otherwise they can't get better. And certainly if you don't do something, eventually you fire them and they're surprised about it. That's the cruelest thing of all.
Right. You know, this is going to sound so basic. And I will tell you, I struggled with this, and I don't know that I'm great at it still, but this is one commitment that I made to myself, and it works really, really well. And you guys are going to laugh when I tell you this, but it's totally true, is I write it down. There's so many times I'm in a meeting, I'm like, oh yeah, we should do this. Oh yeah, I want you to do that. And we don't write it down. And then like a month, I'm like, oh my gosh, and so just simply writing things down. And then when we come back and, you know, we have an RL10 the following week, I'm like, you know, then it's like very clear, right? And the accountability gets, so I know that sounds so basic, but I was the worst at that, you know,
just keeping good notes in a meeting.
Well, hey, I just thought of something. This is real time. And I've been doing this for 27 years, but this is a new idea that you've just given me. And that is, when you see somebody on your team that's not doing something that needs to be held accountable for, go write it down. Go literally just write down. Like, I have Karen sitting here in my office right now. If Karen talks too much during meetings and it's really frustrating people, I should just write down, Karen, you are talking too much during meetings. Just write it down. Now you've put it out there. You've already committed to it on ink. You will probably have the courage to go, hey, I wrote it down. I better share it with her. Right. Don't let it live in your brain.
Well, in this, you text it to her, right? In real time. Right?
No. That's a wussy thing to do.
Yes,
and by the way, when you go talk to her, by the way, be humble enough to go, hey, by the way, I've had people tell me when I do things wrong. It's some of the best things that's happened in my career. I'm going to share something with you, Karen. Now, you're fantastic. I love a lot of things about you. You know that. I'm not telling you you're not good, but I owe it to you to tell you during the meetings when you're talking a lot, I think it kind of turns people off and can be frustrating. Just know that, hey, I've gotten much harder feedback than that, and it really helped me in life. So I'm only sharing this with you because I care about you. That is good. But if you just think it, you will talk yourself out of saying it. I think you should probably literally say, Karen, you are talking too much during meetings and I care too much about you not to tell you. Now you have to do it.
I love it. Right. I love it. No, that's so great. That's so great. So now
we just invented that together.
I like it. Maybe we should just do a real time thing. The things I've been writing down about Dan writing. No, I'm just kidding. So now let's go to our next point. So there's the avoidance of accountability, which leads to the last point and in the five dysfunctions, which is inattention to results. I love this point. I think it's probably my most favorite one because I think this is a hard right to mediocrity when this is done the wrong way. So just let's just talk through that. Can you just explain that concept?
Yeah, most people go, well, what do you mean inattention to results? What else are they paying attention to? And it's like, oh, you know, most people are results oriented, but it's oftentimes my results, my career, my pay, my team, or my clients. It's like, no, it's the collective results of the team. This is about teamwork. And so we talk about this all the time. It's like, you have to be concerned about Acme Pest Control, not Bob's book of business.
Right.
If you're in charge of marketing and the guys that are doing servicing clients are struggling, it's like, well, marketing's doing it. It's like, well, my side of the boat's not sinking. No, there's only one boat. And we all have to care about the collective boat. And I like to talk in the world of sports when like a guy comes out off the bench after the game and they've lost, but he's checking his stats. It's like, who cares? Mm-hmm. Right. Who cares? I love the Scottie Pippen story years ago when he, after Jordan retired, Pippen became the number one player on the team and it was in the playoffs. And there was like 2 seconds left in the game and they had the ball in a tie game against the Knicks in the playoffs. And he said, I get to take the last shot. And the coach said, no, the Tony Kukoc is going to take the last shot. And he goes, no, I get to, I'm the best player. And he goes, no, he'll have a better look at the basket. And Pippen said, if I don't get to take the last shot, then I'm not going to play. And they subbed for him and they took the shot and they won. The point is, this guy was not about the team winning. It's about me. And most of us come out of the womb that way. We've all had those moments.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah. Self-awareness, I mean, something like that. You might think it, but don't say it.
Well, yeah, don't act on it. Yeah, I actually salute him for having the courage to actually act on something he believed.
Yeah. Right.
Although that's not the guy you want on your team. So we learn to trust each other and engage in conflict and hold each other account and commit and hold each other accountable so that we collectively can achieve what we set out to achieve. Great teams produce.
I didn't plan this. We didn't plan this. It would make it look like I'm smarter than I really am. So, you know, I didn't plan it, but it folds right into this next thing that we're going to talk about, which we're going to get to your latest book. And I want to talk about that, which is the ideal team player, because that, you know, the inattention to results, it's Team Donnie versus the team. And, you know, you have the 3 points in there. Someone's hungry, humble, and smart. And I think that humble, like, am I Team Donnie? Or am I actually for the team? And that is a huge, I mean, because I have actually experienced this firsthand, exactly what you're talking about right now. And we try to train it and we emphasize it over and over. And eventually either someone buys in or they don't. And if they don't, then we're like, hey, this is not your jam, right? This is not the place for you. You're going to need to go somewhere else. And everyone knows it, of course. But do you want to, we don't have to go point by point, but can you just kind of describe that? Because I think that's a really important part as far as the ideal team player and how that folds into what you just wrote about the five, not just wrote, but the points that you made about the five dysfunctions of a team.
So I wrote the five dysfunctions of a team. Goodness gracious. How long has it been now? Like 22 years ago. It's been out for 20 years, but about 8 years after that, we realized, oh my gosh, there's qualities in a person that makes them more likely to overcome the five dysfunctions. And we thought those were just our core values, but other teams that we worked with were like, well, hey, we want to use your core values. We're like, no, those are our core values. They're like, no, those are the team's core values. And we realized these three qualities, if a person needs to desire and generally demonstrate all of them, and if they're 3 for 3, it's not like baseball, you can't go 1 for 3, you got to be 3 for 3, then they're going to be a good team player. And if they're lacking one, they really got to work on it. And so these three things are, and so many companies are now using this to hire people. And the three things are humble, people that are about the team, about others, not about themselves first. Their first right. thought is, well, what about everybody else? Not about me, just me.
Yep.
Hungry, which means a work ethic that says, I'm not going to do the bare minimum. I'm going to do whatever needs to be done. And I'm going to go a little above and beyond that, right. or maybe a lot above and beyond that. So humble, hungry. And the last one we call smart, not intelligent. It's smart about dealing with people, that you kind of know that the way you talk to people and the way you act around them is going to influence them. And you're not unaware of the impact you have on them. Humble, right. hungry, and smart. It's so darn simple. I mean, there's no magic in those three words. It's the combination of the three. If you find people who have all three, man, they are like, they slide into a team and start producing right away. Right. But if they're lacking one of them, even one of those in a big way, it's a problem.
Yeah.
And like we like to talk about, let's say somebody's 2 for 3, they're humble and they're hungry, but they're not smart. They're not good with people, but they're not ego driven and they're really hardworking, but they're really bad in dealing with people. We call that the accidental mess maker. They're just constantly creating a mess. They're like that dog that's like, did you poop on the carpet again? Do we have to clean up after you again? And,
yes.
and you're constantly going, hey, he's a great guy or she's a great gal. She just doesn't realize how she impacts people. So that's the accidental mess maker. Well, let's say you're humble and you're smart, but you're not hungry.
Yeah.
That's the lovable slacker.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
fun to be around. Oh, you love them to see them in the office, but they're leaving a little early. They're not getting their work done. You have to pick up, you have to do the extra work. And people are like, oh, he's the greatest guy in the world, but jeez, I gotta finish.
Right.
And it's hard to get rid of them because they're so darn, you know.
Oh my
and the
gosh.
Last one is the most dangerous, though. And that is if they're hungry, they work hard, and they're smart, they're good with people, but they're not humble.
Salespeople.
Right. Yes. Well, like the prototypical, cheesy, non-honest salesperson, right?
Yes, yeah.
Because they know how to give good meeting. They know how to interview well and pretend there's, but at the end of the day, it's all about them. Yeah. Those people on a team are the most dangerous because by the time you figured out that it's about them and not the team, oftentimes a lot of bad things have already happened.
Yeah. Yep.
So what we say is when you interview people, just ask yourself, are they about others more than themselves? Are they willing to go the extra mile? And do they have a clue about how their words and actions affect others? If they're generally 3 for 3 on those, you got yourself a great person.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Dan is about to burst here, so we're going to have to let him go on to death by meeting.
We've got so much to do, but and I only want to cover a couple of points from your perspective because we can do a whole episode on the meeting. But the book Death by Meeting, and my two favorite concepts are the addiction and the four meetings, how you organize a meeting after you realize that it is an addiction. Can you talk about those two points?
Right. Tell me what you mean by the addiction, if you could.
So we got to have a meeting. We got to have a meeting. And meetings are very important. And you know.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Well, and meetings are good, but bad meetings are bad. And the problem, so, you know, it's funny, you guys, and I tell you, a lot of the people listening to this are probably like, hey, if I didn't have to have meetings, I'd love my job more.
Oh,
and,
my gosh. Yeah.
And I get that, but it's really the wrong way to look at it. Because if you think about it, that's like a quarterback on an NFL team saying, hey, if I didn't have to play in these games, I'd really like my job more.
Mm-hmm. If I didn't have a huddle, right?
Right. Or imagine a doctor, if I didn't have to operate on these people, this would be a great gig. Or a teacher, if I didn't have to teach to go to class and teach. Because really, when you're the leader of a company or an organization of any kind, and if you were a technician at one point or a service rep, you thought about the business as just what you were doing with clients, which is wonderful. But if you're going to run an organization, actually having meetings is like the playing field. It's the classroom. Right. It's the operating room. And the problem isn't that meetings are not a good thing. It's bad meetings are bad. And the problem is we're addicted to like going to the meeting and like, okay, we have minutes and we're going to sit here and we're going to run time off the clock. And okay, it's like penance.
Right.
Right. And meetings should be interesting. and they should be dynamic and they should be exhausting and they should be, and you know what's one of the most important things in a meeting? I was a screenwriter, you guys, for fun when I was in college and after I got out. And one of the things I learned, what makes every movie great is that there's conflict.
Right.
Like there's something worth caring about. Right. Watch a movie and realize at the end you go, I really didn't care about those characters. I really didn't care how it resolved. A great movie will hook you at the beginning and you're like, oh no, how is this going to turn out? And you're in it because you're like, this matters. And if our meetings are boring and without any sort of stakes at play, then it's not going to be good. But then we get to your next point, Dan. And that
But before you do that, what drives me batshit crazy, if I'm in a meeting and I see someone on their phone or I see someone like off, they're off, like, you know, they're not there. And I'm like, okay, either this meeting sucks or this, like, you know what I mean? Like, cause that it's very good feedback that either A, this person's not engaged or B, you're screwing up. Right. And I'm talking about the leader here.
But, yeah. Well, and here's the thing, Alan Mulally, who turned the Ford Motor Company around, who I know Alan, you know, one of the most important things he did, one of the many things he did, they changed their meetings and everybody had to go. And he would do the same thing a sixth grade teacher would do and say, get off your phone.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
I've done that.
Trying to turn this company around. Get off your phone. Yep, and you don't have to say it like that. And I'm sure he was nice about it, but it's like, that's not inappropriate for somebody to go, hey, do you realize this meeting is about this company and about our clients and about our livelihoods? I think if something's happening, you need to be on your phone. You need to say, hey, you guys, I got an emergency with a customer or my husband or my wife. I need to take this. That's fine. But if you're just kind of looking at your phone and doing something like that,
checking
what does that say?
And other people see it too. You know what I mean? Like other people in the room see it. So anyway, it's really bad. I don't want to run off on a tangent here, but I mean, it's just point being that, you know, when you know that you don't have a great meeting or there's something going on, if that's going on. So Dan, go ahead.
So let's go back to those, the four meeting points that are the points that.
Reason why meetings are so bad is one, cause they're boring. Cause we don't make them interesting, but the other kind is we don't know what kind of a meeting it is. And there's actually different kinds of meetings and we tend to mix them all together. We tend to go, hey, we're going to meet once a week and we're going to have a meeting, but it's really four different meetings all smushed together. And nobody's going to be quite sure which one we're having at any given point in time. And at the end of it, everybody's going to be confused. I call it meeting stew, right? But it's not a good stew. It's like we got sugar in there. We got salt in there. We got butter. We got peanuts. We got fruit. And people are like, this tastes like crap. And it's like, yeah, that's because we're mixing things together that don't belong in the same pot.
Right.
And here's the good news. If we separate the ingredients and have them at the right times, we will actually, first of all, the meetings will get really good. Secondly, we'll end up saving time because it will be clear. So here's the four kind of meetings. And let's just say somebody's listening to this and they have seven people in their office or four people in their office and 30 employees. You know, the other ones are serving clients out there, coming in and out, but you got four people running the office. You should probably have four different kind of meetings. The first one is once a day for 5 to 10 minutes. When you get to the office, you should just, we call it the daily stand-up. It's completely administered. Like, hey, what's everybody doing today? What are you working on? You know, like it's what's going on today that we need to know about at the office. That's it. No agenda, nothing else. 5 to 10 minutes. That's doing that every day solves so many problems that people like are like, oh, I didn't know that. It's like, yeah, at the beginning of the day, just go, I'm doing this. I'm doing this. I'm calling this guy today and I'm going to leave because I have to do this. And if everybody knows what everybody else is doing, life gets a lot easier.
Right.
Okay. That's called your daily stand-up. The next one is what we call the weekly tactical. This is what we call a staff meeting. This is like where once a week you get together and you go, okay, let's take a look at how are we doing with our clients? What's revenue look like this week? What's the bookings look like this week? Do we have any issues? Do we have any problems? And it's just like a regular thing where you're going through and looking at your regular metrics and how's the business going and what do we need to do this week to solve any of these near-term problems? Okay, that's the one that people should have once a week, but they shouldn't include all that other stuff. The next one we call, this is the most fun. It's called an ad hoc strategic meeting. This is where something big happens like, oh no, we have a competitor entered our market. Or, oh no, there's a huge infestation of cicadas coming in. You guys know about this that's going on, right? Or something going on in the market that and don't talk about it for 15 minutes during your weekly meeting. Go, let's go have a meeting for an hour and a half, get some beers and some pizza and sit there, roll up our sleeves and actually figure it out.
Right.
See, don't take a really interesting, sexy, interesting, messy topic and try to talk about it for 10 or 15 minutes in the middle of your weekly, you know, mm-hmm. reports. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you're going to have to do that. And then the last kind is once a quarter, just get out of the office, go someplace for a few hours or half a day and just go, how are we doing? How's the market? How are our behaviors? What's the business look like?
Right.
How are our best people? Are we keeping our best people? Are we at risk of losing anybody? Take a breath, like a race car driver. You got to slow down every once in a while to go fast. Mm-hmm. So there's four different kind of meetings. Now, most leaders of companies are, I don't want to have four meetings. One's enough. It's like, no. You're having one big crappy meeting.
Right.
If every day you spent 5 or 10 minutes, just, and then every week you spent 90 minutes having your weekly tactical, and every couple weeks you have a 90 minute meeting to talk about something really interesting, your problem. And then once a quarter you go off for 3 hours and you review, you'll actually save a crap load of time.
So let's say you're running a pest control company. And as you said, there's 30 people and 25 of them are on the road. Some are salespeople, some are technicians, and the rest are in the office. Who goes to the meetings? So you have four meetings.
And this is the thing. And this is, in a small business, is a different animal than others. Like if it's a 500 person company, the CEO has like four direct reports and everybody reports up to them. That's a little easier. I think in a thing like that, if literally you have salespeople, not the head of sales, but the salespeople and the field people out there, I think it's the people in the office. And when in doubt, if there's four or five people in the office, I don't care if it's the administrative assistant, they probably know more about what's going on in that business. I would probably want them in that meeting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the quarterly meeting, do you bring everyone in or do you just do the?
You can, but that's a different kind of, that's a company meeting. And that's a great thing to do, by the way. That's a great thing to do. But also the four people that are running the business on a daily basis, once a quarter, they just have to get there. They go, hey, how are we doing?
Right. Love it.
You know, how are things going?
So let's fast forward now. And now let's talk about the latest thing that you've been working on, which is the six types of working genius. I know you talked about that earlier. Can you just kind of give us an overview of, like, this is why I wrote this. Here's what it does. I mean, our listeners, I imagine that most of our listeners, if they've had any kind of experience I've had as we are been talking, I'm like, I got to go back and reread these books. Because they had to be reminded. But can you just talk through your latest project and kind of, first of all, why? What does it do? And then just maybe just high level, this is what you're going to get out of it if you go down this path.
Yeah. So the five dysfunctions of a team was the biggest thing we've ever done. But this new thing, the six types of working genius, is bigger. We're convinced of that. And so far what we've seen, and almost 1 million people now have done this in the past few years. It came about, like everything else, by accident. I was frustrated at work. So I was running my own small company, like many of the people listening to this. I liked the people I was working with. I liked running a company. I loved what we did. And yet I would come to work excited to be there, and then I'd get frustrated. And half the time, by noon, I'd be complaining. And I was the grumpy, and I didn't know why. And one of the people that worked for me said, why do you get grumpy all the time? And I'd be like, I don't know, but I want to change it. And so I one day, by the grace of God, I sat there and I said, okay, so what am I doing when I'm grumpy? What am I doing? Oh, I'm doing this, but I don't really like to do that, but it's necessary. And I came up with these six different activities that every kind of enterprise needs. I don't care if you're planning a family vacation, rebuilding a house, starting a business, launching a new product. Anything you do requires six activities. And I realized two of them I loved. And I'd come to work every day excited about doing two. And every day I'd get dragged into doing something that I didn't like.
Can I guess what they are? Is it wonder and invention? Is that your two?
I'm thinking, no. I'm thinking tenacity is
No, I have no tenacity.
Really?
So it's great. It's invention and discernment.
Okay. So I was at least 50%.
Oh, you were very close. No, you were right in the right ballpark. And my wife is wonder and invention, which means, get this, you guys, the last three, which are when the work actually has to get done, the galvanizing, enabling, and tenacity, because it starts like up in the clouds.
The
first one is way up in the clouds. It's called wonder. And some people have a God-given ability to ponder things and to notice things and go, hey, you know something? I think there's something going on in our market. I don't know if our customers are happy. Or have you ever thought about this? They don't have an idea. They have a question. Mm-hmm. And it's critical. And then I come along and I go, I love your question. I'm going to solve that. Like the woman said to me, why are you grumpy? I don't know why, but you get grumpy a lot. And I was like, I don't know, but I want to figure it out.
Right. That's the invention.
Yeah.
That's the invention. Right?
Those are the first two. The next one is called discernment, which is people have instinct and gut feel, and they can just look at an idea and tell if it's going to work or not. They have intuition and instinct. They kind of look at things in patterns, and you're going like, how do you know? And they're like, I don't know. I'm just pretty sure. And they're usually right. Mm-hmm. It's a natural gift. The next one was the one I don't have that I was asked to do every day, which is called galvanizing. And galvanizers are the kind of people who love to get people motivated and sell. And they're inspiring people. Come on, let's do it. They remind people. Well, I don't like doing that all the time. And every day I'd come to work and they were like, galvanize us, galvanize us. And I would get kind of pissed off. I didn't know why.
You're frustrating me.
Well, you know, that's funny. One man's trash is another man's treasure. A guy who worked for me loved galvanizing. Uh-huh. And he didn't get to do it in his job because it didn't look like he was supposed to. And I was like, why don't you galvanize? And I don't have to do it as much. And he was like, mm-hmm. Could I really? I turned his job into a better job. I made my job a better job. Mm-hmm. Just by understanding that we have different gifts.
I love it.
The last two after galvanizing are enablement, which is helping others do things, which is an absolutely God-given gift, and every business needs one.
Right.
And the last one is tenacity, Dan. Now, I've written 13 books, so you think you must have tenacity, right? If I didn't have people that worked with me that didn't have more tenacity than me, I would have written zero books because I would have never finished. I'm not a finisher.
Right. You would have 13 various stage books.
Yes.
Oh, I love it.
And when you have a team, let's say you have four or five people in your office and you look at this, there's a team report that you print out and it shows like, do you have any gaps on your team? And teams will look at it. It takes 12 minutes to fill it out. You get your results instantly and you look at it and you go, oh, we don't have one person with tenacity on our team. Or nobody here wonders. Nobody here is ever like pondering like, maybe there's a better way. Teams right away look at it and go, okay, there's our problem. That's why that project failed. That's why these tend to work.
Right.
And it really is one of the fastest ways to have big ahas about how your team is working.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic.
So once you read the book or listen to it on audio or whatever, is there a piece of software that you use? Is there consulting? What is it? How do you take the next step?
Well, I would actually, I can't believe I'm going to say this. I actually think reading the book is great. But I think you can just go take it costs $25 and it takes 12 minutes to take the test. And you go to workinggenius.com and you fill it out. And we wrote this assessment so that it really gets at the heart of what gives you joy and energy and what drains you of joy and energy. So I would say take the assessment. The report explains what it is. Most people do it and they look at their results and they get it. Now, the mm-hmm. book explains how it came about and how to go deeper with it. But I don't think you need to read a book. My books are short, but I don't think you need to take 2 hours to read a book before you actually learn who you are.
Yeah.
And we see literally, we've seen teams. I worked with like a $10 billion software company and they took this assessment and like 20 minutes later, they were reorganizing their team because they were like, oh, nobody, they were a software company. And they said, the only person on our executive team that has invention is the head lawyer.
Oh my.
Not the head of products.
That is a big problem. I mean,
they still, you know, something?
They reorganized the lawyer's job and he took on new technology acquisition.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And he was like thrilled and they were thrilled.
Yes.
So like in your office, you can look at this and the leader is going to look at this and go, like we talked before about being vulnerable and going first. They're going to look at it and they're going to go, oh, you guys, did you know that I suck at these two things? And they go, yeah, boss, we knew. And he's going to go like, yeah, I know too. How can we get stuff done better? Because we're relying on me to do stuff that I'm terrible at.
Yeah.
It's great.
That's great. Yeah. Patrick, listen, this has been absolutely amazing. We're going to link up all of your books. We're going to link up the survey that you talked about on our show notes, on our website. We do like a show notes, which now AI is doing a ton of it, but I don't want to cut short Marisa because she's the one that puts it all together, does an amazing job. But if people want to learn more about you, they want to learn more about what you're doing. There's obviously Amazon. Is there anything else that you can recommend to them? I want to give you a little bit of time, just at least, you know, straight to our listeners. Where do they go? What do they do? How do they connect with you if that's what they want to do?
Yeah, we're called The Table Group. So tablegroup.com is our website, which has everything on it. So workinggenius.com is this product. That, if you want to just do that, workinggenius.com, that's where you go. But The Table Group is my company.
Gotcha.
And so you can check out everything there, anything from books to speaking to products to consulting and everything else. And we don't ever sell to people. When people call us, we just try to help them figure out what they need. So if that means we don't have to sell them anything, we're glad to do that.
No,
that's good stuff.
This has been fantastic, Patrick. I feel like we could talk to you all day, like legitimately.
Yeah.
Like
Well, let me tell your listeners something. I don't know how many podcasts they listen, but you guys are really good at this. I'm on a lot of podcasts. I have my own podcast called At the Table, which is where we just talk about company culture and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You guys are really good at this, and I'm on a lot of them, and so I've really enjoyed this. Time is fun.
I appreciate that.
How long we've been on.
It's always fun making fun of Dan, by the way.
No, it's all the ingredients, right? So
Well, some people are easy to make fun of, and Dan, we appreciate that.
Right? Yes, that's exactly.
Right. That's right.
All righty. Well, you all have managed to spend a little bit more time with Dan and I and our very special guest, Patrick. Patrick, thanks again. Just a reminder that all the resources and topics that we talked about today is available on our podcast website, pnpindustryinsider.com. Just take a look under show notes. Like I mentioned earlier, we'll put up all of Patrick's books. We'll link his website. We'll link that assessment. We always appreciate any ratings and reviews that you give us, so long as they're positive. If you have complaints or concerns, we always ask that you direct that with Dan. And with that, we're going to sign out. Patrick, thanks so much. It's been great.
Thanks
so much.
We'll
see you all next time.
Terrific time.
God bless you guys.
Thank you. Bye.